This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Emily Burke. Tonight, concern about undetected chains of transmission as more mystery cases of COVID pop up well outside Sydney's northern beaches. Also, the World Health Organization warns that even vaccinated travellers will need to go into quarantine. And 2020 saw a boom in new companies listed on the stock exchange. It's proving irresistible for novice investors.
You get a lot of hot money coming in, and I think that's the most difficult part for new investors is to actually work out what's going to be a stayer, what's going to be a high quality stock down the track.
It's been almost 2 weeks since the discovery of a COVID cluster on Sydney's northern beaches. And today, the New South Wales Premier said the risk posed by coronavirus is now almost as great across the rest of Sydney. Just three new COVID cases have been linked to the Avalon cluster, but another three so far unlinked across the rest of the state has authorities worried. There's concern too in Queensland, where a South African variant of coronavirus, believed to be more contagious, has been detected in a returned traveller who's now in hospital. Isabel Rowe reports.
With Sydney's northern beaches coronavirus cluster now seemingly contained, attention is turning once again to the rest of the city.
Ironically, as we see time move on, the threat in Greater Sydney is almost becoming as equal to parts of the northern beaches.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says new coronavirus cases linked to the northern beaches cluster are getting smaller each day, with just three to report today. But it's the cases outside of that area that are worrying the state's Chief Health Officer, Kerry Chan.
We received one notification very late last night and a couple of notifications this morning of cases that have presented for testing that are not immediately linked to the cluster.
There are three mystery cases, one in the north of Sydney, one in the inner west and the other in Wollongong, something Kerry Chant says is so far unexplained.
Those investigations are ongoing. We believe that they had spent some time in the central business district or the centre of the city, but again, it's premature. We thought it was critically important to let the public know about that because the numbers overnight were actually very reassuring that we had those three cases and they were all in isolation. This highlights how the situation can change quite rapidly.
The message, as always, keep coming forward to get a test.
Whilst many weeks ago I would have been happy with 16,329 tests in a 24-hour period, for me now I'd want to see those numbers pushed up well over the 20 to 30,000.
And that momentum needs to be kept up for weeks, not days, according to University of New South Wales epidemiologist Professor Raina McIntyre.
I note the Premier was talking about January the 3rd as a sort of litmus test, but that's 2 weeks from Christmas Day, so I think she's looking at the incubation period following Christmas Day. To me, the bigger worry is the 2 weeks after New Year's Eve. So I think the time to really look out for, do extra testing and enhance the wastewater surveillance, etc., will be the first 2 weeks of January.
With that in mind, New South Wales Police say they'll be watching Sydneysiders during Thursday night's New Year's Eve celebrations and breaking up large illegal gatherings. Gatherings like this one. Hundreds of people joined an impromptu party at Bronte Beach on Christmas Day, thought to be mostly backpackers and working holiday visa holders from the UK and Europe. The Federal Immigration Minister, Alex Hawke, is unimpressed.
We're quite shocked to see people who've been here a while now, who've seen the situation around the world, who understand the state of the world and what we're in, breaching public health orders when we have an outbreak in Sydney.
He says those caught breaching public health orders that day or on New Year's Eve could be sent home.
Well, I've asked the Department of Home Affairs to work with the New South Wales Police and state agencies, and they will do that. And again, if we become aware of people who have breached their visa conditions and threatened the public health and safety of others, we will take action under the Migration Act. And I think people expect us to do that.
The financial impost of the pandemic continues for Greater Sydney businesses, with authorities encouraging people to avoid bars and restaurants for New Year's Eve if they can. And for some on the northern beaches, it's getting desperate.
Please stop saying you feel for us. Just do something to help us.
Sonia Backhouse's business sells craft supplies and runs art workshops at Warriewood in the northern part of the northern beaches. And like all non-essential business in that area, she's been shut down until the 9th of January.
We lost a lot of supplies that were purchased, you know, flowers and things like that, that just, you know, weren't able to be used. But we're kind of just being left in the lurch now, the fact that we're being told to shut down for longer than anybody.
The Premier said today the message was to businesses to keep trading, but you're in that position that you're actually not allowed to.
We keep hearing this over and over again. Not all businesses are food-related businesses and can do takeaway. So that's all fine and dandy, but it just feels like the non-food businesses are being completely forgotten here, and there are thousands of us.
New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says her government is thinking about a financial stimulus package for Northern Beaches businesses. Sonia Backhouse is frustrated it hasn't come sooner.
Now all we're hearing is we are considering some kind of support. Well, we've heard considering promises in the past. That's not going to help us right now.
Northern Beaches business owner Sonia Backhouse ending Isabel Rowe's report. Well, pathology labs in New South Wales are operating at full tilt as they process the thousands of swabs from residents across the state. But the New South Wales Premier and the Chief Health Officer have expressed concern about the sudden decline in testing rates. Just 16,000 samples were collected yesterday. They want daily testing numbers to hit between 20 and 30,000. Professor Dominic Dwyer is Director of Public Health at New South Wales Health Pathology. I spoke to him earlier and asked him about the public appeal for more testing.
Well, look, I think the key to managing this outbreak in New South Wales has been aggressive and early testing. So we've been doing that really from the get-go. It's been shown that the more you test, obviously the more likely you are to pick up positive cases, and really the amount of testing in the last 2 weeks has been extraordinary. Of course, we all worry when the testing numbers decrease because we think, well, are we missing cases by not testing everybody? So that's why there's always a pretty constant request for people to come forward.
Is it clear why the numbers have fallen away so quickly, given there were numbers around the 60,000 mark just before Christmas?
Look, there's a number of factors that contribute to this. First of all, I think perhaps a week or 2 weeks ago, there was a high level of anxiety, had been identifying new cases in the northern beaches, which hadn't had a lot of activity before. Everybody was worried. Everybody knew that a lockdown was going to happen or possible. Everyone knew Christmas was coming and all the shopping and the family activities and all of that sort of stuff, the holidays, all of that was potentially going to contribute to easier spread of the virus. So for those reasons, I think the community themselves figured out that it was a very good idea to be tested. So the numbers really went up in the surge of activity. Now, there's no doubt that fatigue can set in. People get a bit kind of sick of it. People who've had one test think, well, why do I need another one? But again, that's still important, particularly if they get any symptoms. So it's a combination of factors that contribute to the rise and fall and rise again in testing numbers.
And are the labs working 24/7? What's the roster look like?
Oh, well, look, again, you know, one really want, you know, it'd be really good to shout out to the laboratory workers because they have been going 24/7. We started off initially with just the one lab at Westmead doing this right at the very beginning. It's now expanded to well over 35 public laboratories in New South Wales, including small ones in rural and regional areas. And the private sector have also stepped up. You know, we've rolled out testing really dramatically in a widespread fashion to make sure that everybody doesn't have to go too far to get a test and that the results don't take too long.
The government wants testing numbers to sit around the 20 to 30,000 mark each day. Are the labs geared up to manage those numbers?
They are. So, again, you know, there's a massive scramble for all of this sort of work early in the piece, sort of, you know, March and April of this year when we had a lot of activity of COVID-19 in Sydney, with a lot of rapid paddling in the water, you know, there was the opportunity to get a lot of equipment and people trained and so on. So we now have that capacity built in. So there's not a capacity issue so much as an issue of getting the public in for testing and having the public, you know, understand why, where they can go, how they do it, you know, keep coming back and you know, that sort of stuff's a communication issue as much as anything else.
The emergence of these new strains of COVID, will that pose a particular challenge for the labs at all?
It's something that the labs always do regularly. So, for example, in our lab at Westmead, if you take something like influenza, which, you know, everybody knows changes and mutates every year, well, we check each year that our laboratory tests are going to capture any new strains or variants that might appear. The same thing with COVID-19. So there have been new mutations emerge, as you would expect with one of these sorts of viruses. Whether these impact on the laboratory is something that's actually looked at very carefully. What we do is we actually have some redundancy built into it. So in our testing, we test for a couple of parts of the virus genetic material, not just one bit. So if there's a mutation in one bit, we've got other bits that might come up that help us confirm whether the infection is there. And so with the variant that's being discussed in the United Kingdom, and the same from the one in South Africa and other places as well, we check those against our tests regularly to make sure that we're not missing them.
You're heading to China as part of a team of experts exploring mm-hmm. the origins of coronavirus. When do you go? Do you have a date on when you will set off?
Looks as though it'll be next week sometime. There's still issues around sorting out visas and those sorts of things. But the plan will be to go next week, and everybody from the different parts of the world that are coming in will try and all sort of arrive around the same time, because everyone has to do 2 weeks in quarantine in China as well. And so we want everybody to be doing that around the same time, so people can work and start getting underway with things even while they're in quarantine.
I wonder whether you have any concerns about your ability to thoroughly investigate and about the transparency from officials in China, given the arrest of a citizen journalist who'd been reporting on the outbreak in Wuhan.
Look, I don't have any concerns. I mean, of course, there's always an anxiety about going off and doing this sort of work. But, look, my experience with SARS back in 2003 was that once you sort of spoke to your peer group, if you like, in China, the other scientists and doctors and so on, everybody wants to know what's going on, them included. I mean, there's clearly politics around it, and people make commentary in political circles or in the media, but my job, I'm not paid enough to be a politician, so my job is to focus on the science and to do that as well as can be done. I don't think we're going to find an immediate answer on day one, but hopefully put in place some mechanisms to help the people on the ground in China and indeed elsewhere in the world, you know, work out how to do the right sorts of investigations to find out the origins of the virus.
You're not at all concerned about your safety?
No, I'm not concerned about my safety at all. I've been to China on a number of occasions for work and never had any anxiety about it from the safety point of view at all. So I don't see that this would be any different. I mean, you could say that the World Health Organization is a very important international body. So I think that actually gives some safety to the whole process. So no, I'm not concerned.
That's Professor Dominic Dwyer, Director of Public Health at New South Wales Health Pathology. Well, the world has been holding out hope all year that a vaccine would create a path back to, well, something looking like normal. But the World Health Organization says even though vaccines have been created, none of those will necessarily stop the spread of the virus. Rather, only stop the virus from becoming a serious disease inside our bodies. It means the two-week quarantine system for travellers is most likely here to stay and will also be used for people who've been vaccinated. Rachel Mealy has the story.
With vaccine injections suddenly the subject of optimistic news coverage, the World Health Organization wants to temper the world's hopes, warning that even those inoculated against COVID-19 may infect others.
We're learning now, and we continue to wait for more results from the vaccine trials, is to really understand if these vaccines, apart from preventing symptomatic disease and severe disease and deaths, whether they're also going to reduce infections or preventing people from getting infected with the virus, prevent them from passing it on or transmitting it.
The WHO's chief scientist, Dr. Sumia Swaminathan, says there's just not enough evidence to show that the vaccines cut down on infection rates across a population.
I think till we know more, we need to assume that people who have been vaccinated also need to take the same precautions.
Professor Paul Griffin is the Director of Infectious Diseases at the Mater Hospital in Brisbane. He says clinical trials for vaccine efficacy aren't designed to look at whether or not infection rates are reduced, and this is a much harder matter to prove.
We're clear already that the vaccines that are progressing well through clinical trials or, in fact, through regulatory approvals definitely do that. In terms of whether they do other things as well, it's not that we know they don't, it's just that they're harder to prove. So while there's a lot of talk that we haven't yet shown these vaccines reduce transmission, it's not to say that they won't at least have some effect on that. So that's information that will be borne out in time, hopefully. But yes, the main way we know these vaccines are achieving the excellent results they are is through reducing progression to severe disease.
Professor Griffin does sound an optimistic note, though. He says a vaccinated person would shed fewer virus particles and therefore be less infectious.
The thing is, when people say we haven't proven they reduce transmission, well, we know that the way this virus is transmitted is, you know, through having viral particles in droplets that are predominantly admitted in higher numbers through things like coughing. And so if we reduce symptoms such as coughing, well, we are going to reduce how easily people are able to transmit to others. So while it might not be a direct action on reducing viral shedding, for example, we know that reducing clinical disease will have an impact on transmission and therefore epidemiology eventually. So even if the vaccine isn't predominantly directly reducing transmission, they will help.
But what does this all mean for global travel? Can vaccinated Australians fly back in and skip quarantine? Professor Griffin says no.
I mean, I think we know that you need exceptional vaccine coverage in people that are travelling, but also in the destinations people are going to have an impact on the epidemiology there to reduce that risk. And it's very unlikely that that's going to be a short-term outcome. And so to make sure we keep Australia safe, given how great our control has been, even with the vaccine rolling out here, it's not going to be that we can completely scrap our quarantine program.
Russia is among the destinations off limits for the foreseeable future. Just last week, Vladimir Putin spoke at his annual press conference and boasted that Russia had outperformed other countries in its management of the pandemic.
This tsunami of issues has hit the entire world, not just Russia. But we can safely say that we were up to scratch. We rose to the challenge. In many ways better than any other country in the world.
Russian health officials have registered 3 million cases since the pandemic began, the fourth highest in the world. But until now, the death toll was reported to be a little over 55,000 because official COVID deaths weren't declared without an autopsy. Now, the Russian government has corrected the record and says more than 186,000 people have died from COVID-19. Vladimir Putin and his government are pinning their hopes on a locally developed vaccine named Sputnik V.
Rachel Mealy reporting. And you're listening to PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. Still to come, Buyer Beware, the highly risky investment program that's got a lot of attention in 2020.
There is risk with IPOs, but I think that with rising share markets and optimism going into 2021, clients of all ages are happy to roll the dice. They think, okay, well, let's put a little bit of money in and see how we go with these IPOs.
As the La Nina weather pattern brings rain to the east of the country, there's a glimmer of hope that much-needed water will make its way to catchments further inland. 2 years ago, millions of fish were killed amid dwindling water levels in major river systems, blamed largely on drought and the demands of irrigation. Communities are desperate for the rivers to flow again, with some waterways in the west of New South Wales reduced to small ponds. But some say it will all depend on how the water is managed, or this chance at reprieve will be thrown away. Nancy Notson reports.
Big cod. Another big cod over there.
They were images that sparked outrage across the country. Millions of dead fish floating in the river near Menindee in the southwest of New South Wales, an area that's part of the Murray-Darling Basin, one of the largest and most complex river systems in Australia.
There was fish just from one side of the river to the other for about 30 kilometres.
Menindee local Graham McCrabb was one of the first to discover the gruesome scene. He says the community still hasn't recovered.
People are really nervous now about water security. I think it highlighted the issues around water security that people had been concerned about for probably decades. Certainly fishing and that pastime is certainly hasn't been as good this year. So our traditional owners certainly rely on golden perch and cod as a protein source, and that's been greatly reduced. The ability to catch fish here has been reduced.
That fish kill was followed by the deaths of even more fish in rivers and lakes around New South Wales, like this one in the Namoi River near Gunnedah in the state's north.
Oh, yellow belly's dead.
They're all yellow belly out there.
But that same river has recently been subject to flood warnings, thanks to generous falls from the La Nina weather event in northern New South Wales.
And a lot of those areas just on the western side of the Great Dividing Range are part of the tributaries that flow into the Darling River. And eventually that rainfall will make its way down those rivers all the way to Menindee if there's enough of it.
Professor Richard Kingsford is a river ecologist and director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. He says while it could take months for the water to first fill dams and then make its way down the system, this La Nina will be critical in terms of ensuring there will be widespread flooding across the Murray-Darling Basin, allowing ecosystems and water quality to spring back to life.
Because it's only then that that water gets out onto the floodplains, allows the sort of food webs to kick in, those coolabahs and river red gums that depend on that water flooding can then get enough to sort of flower and regenerate.
It's been years since these systems have seen decent falls, enough to ensure their ongoing sustainability. But it's feared this rare opportunity could be scuttled if too much water is irrigated from the system before it gets to where it's needed.
We need to establish what levels of floodplain harvesting are sustainable. We know that floodplain harvesting has occurred in the Darling River catchments since the late 80s and perhaps a little bit before. But unfortunately, it's also increased after the Murray-Darling Basin cap was implemented, which was a commitment by governments in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia to keep levels of extraction at 93, 94 levels. At the moment, we know that there's been ongoing development, and that is really bringing the Darling River to its knees.
But irrigators and authorities say new rules and regulations will help keep things in check. Claire Miller is the CEO of the New South Wales Irrigators Council.
There's the Healthy Floodplains Project, and under that, floodplain harvesting, the capability to catch water when it's flooding, the volumes will be reduced way back down to the 1994 cap on diversions, which is lower than the sustainable diversion limits in the basin plan. That licensing will come into effect from the 1st of July, and it's in tandem with metering to make sure that no one is taking any more than they're entitled to. So that is going to improve flows throughout the system.
A spokesperson for the New South Wales Water Minister says authorities will be enforcing that metering. and that the government has recently implemented embargoes on floodplain harvesting in some areas to protect this first crucial movement of water towards the Lower Darling.
Nancy Notson with that report. There's a boom in companies floating on stock exchanges around the world, and there's evidence plenty of investment novices, weary of earning nothing on bank deposits, are keen to dabble in the market. This year, 115 companies have listed on the Australian Securities Exchange, up 25% on last year. And financial planners say their clients are handing over their cash to buy up the fledgling stocks. While investment returns can reach well into the double digits, financial experts warn investing in companies yet to prove their worth is highly risky. Our business reporter David Taylor has been looking at the trend.
Danielle Akuye invests in companies that are new to the stock exchange. She says right now it's a goldmine.
Because the market is quite bullish and frothy at the moment, and there's a lot of momentum behind a lot of the new IPOs.
She's made money on some stocks that have shot up after hitting the boards.
Over in the US, I did incredibly well out of Zoom because I held it pretty much post its listing. And as you know, that kind of, you know, went through the roof. I have since sold that.
But she's also lost thousands of dollars on some that flopped shortly after listing.
So in the case of FINEOS, which I bought into, I'm currently sitting on an unrealised loss of 21%, but I'm not selling that stock. In the case of Adore, I'm currently sitting on around a 7% loss.
An initial public offering is when a private company applies to list on the stock exchange, so shares in it can be publicly traded. Danielle Akuye says record low interest rates are helping drive stocks higher, but investor sentiment is also being propped up by billions in government stimulus and promise of a coronavirus vaccine in 2021. She calls it hot money.
Excuse the expression, but it's kind of like the pump and dump scenario. And I think that's the most difficult part for new investors is to actually work out what's going to be a stayer, what's going to be a high quality stock down the track versus one that's just going to have a whole lot of hot money, a whole lot of momentum, a whole lot of traders moving in. And they go, okay, I've made my 20, 30, 40, 50%, depending on how strong the market is.
The Australian Securities Exchange declined an interview, but told PM it's been a bumper year for company listings. The ASX also said that its pipeline of new listings extended well into the third week of December, when it's normally wrapping up in the first. And it said that it's definitely been some time since we've experienced so many listings in such a concentrated period. James Gerard is a Sydney-based financial planner. It's his job to advise clients whether or not investing in an initial public offering is right for them or not.
And a really good example of that was Aussie Broadband, which is an NBN retailer, which allowed their existing customer base to participate and become shareholders of that company. So we saw quite a lot of our clients contact us who were customers of Aussie Broadband and ask, was it a good investment?
And what sort of returns can investors expect with an IPO?
Typically, the investment banks who help companies go onto the share market try to price the IPOs well so that when the company goes onto the share market, the share price should be pretty stable. But there's a lot of optimism out there in share markets. There's a lot of expected stimulus from governments next year. So what that's meaning is that investors are prepared to pay more money for new companies that come onto the share market, which is meaning that it's not uncommon to see first day closing prices be 50 or 100% higher than what people paid to enter those stocks at the IPO.
James Gerard explains that once you've filled out a prospectus, sent it in, and the company hits the boards of the stock exchange, you can sell out at any time, even minutes after the company lists. It's an opportunity to make a lot of cash quickly. Equally, says Mr. Gerard, you can lose a lot of money in an instant too.
So, for example, if that company that you bought IPO'd for $2 per share, but the share market fell, it was only worth $1, you could be down 50% on the first day. So it's a little bit of a sort of a venture into the unknown when you buy into an IPO.
And trader Danielle Akuye warns most amateur investors don't have the stomach for such risky trading activities, especially those who aren't following the market every minute of the day.
Because it takes a long while to determine whether you're holding a really good quality company that is going to turn into, you know, the next CSL or the next next ResMed or the next Fortescue, but they don't reveal themselves straight away. And that's the problem for most people. They can't differentiate over a short time span about the quality of the company, the quality and resilience of the earnings, just by looking at the share price and how it reacts on the share market, which is largely driven by short-term traders and momentum and hype and sentiment and all those other things that are going on at the moment.
And the IPO boom is a global phenomenon. According to data provider Refinitiv, businesses raised almost $300 billion through flotations globally in 2020. In Australia this year, companies have raised $5.2 billion from investors.
David Taylor, our business reporter. And that's PM for this Tuesday. I'm Emily Burke. Thanks for your company. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.